Good afternoon. It's November 1st, 2014. My name is Bruce Director. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. I'm the host for today. And I have in the studio with me Benjamin Denniston, who's well known to many of our listeners as one of the key figures in Lyndon LaRouche's basement team. Ben has just recently published on the LaRouche Pack website, www.larouchepack.com, a new report called Science for a New Paradigm, Time for a Solar Noosphere, which has a curious title, and you can't actually tell what the content of the paper is by the title until you read the whole thing. So he was very skillful in choosing a title to entice you to read the paper. But the paper deals with some revolutionary new ideas in science that are quite relevant for the world political situation. And just let me underscore that we are sitting right now in a period of history, as LaRouche said earlier today, where we could see a major shift in world politics right now, especially with the what is hopefully the impending disintegration of the Obama administration and a replacement of Obama with a much more happy perspective for the United States. And when you look at this situation, as much of our listeners know, we've been sitting here in a world which is characterized by two very stark contrasts. On the one hand, you have the conditions of the economy of North America and the European system, which continues to look very dismal. No progress, no innovation, nothing new, nothing startling, and a lot of despair. And meanwhile, you see some really exciting things happening in the so-called BRICS countries, especially led by Russia, China, India, and then the others, Brazil, and so forth. And this is characterized by new developments in science, technology, culture, and a commitment on the part of the leadership of those countries, especially Xi Jinping of China, Narendra Modi of India, Vladimir Putin in Russia, and the recently elected Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. And this is a leadership which is actually looking towards the future in a very hopeful way. We have reports today, for example, that China in the last 8 days has sent a rocket, a spacecraft around the moon and back to Earth with a brand new, never before tried re-entry technique, and brought the capsule safely back to Earth. This is the intermediate stage between their current most recent project where they put a rover on the moon to the next stage of their space program, which is intended to bring a craft to land on the moon, take off, and come back and bring lunar samples back to Earth. This is all preparatory towards a Chinese program to actually set up a mining capability on the moon to mine helium-3, which is the ideal fuel for fusion energy. So you have these two contrasts in the world. You have on the one hand this very exciting, optimistic future orientation from the BRICS countries, and then you have this sort of pessimism and what the news media calls the new normal for the transatlantic elite is a new dark age of nothing very good happening. And Ben has entered into this situation a new idea, which is actually based on old ideas, and especially the work of earlier in this century of the great Russian scientist Vladimir Vernadsky on dealing with the implications for our thinking of what I just described. What is it that's going on in the minds of people between the BRICS countries and the minds of people in the transatlantic area? What does this reveal about fundamental questions of science and the nature of the universe? So I'm happy to welcome Ben to this discussion.
Hi, Bruce.
It's good to have you here. It's good to have you here. So now we've, I think, completely perplexed people. They say, what the hell is this science for a new paradigm, time for a solar noosphere? So why don't we jump right into it? And first, let me just ask you, why'd you pick that title?
Well, it's the whole thing has been provoked by Mr. LaRouche's recent, not a new emphasis, but I would say a recent re-emphasis on the importance of the difference between man and beast from a as a real scientific conception. So in some discussions with him...
So you're talking about this from a real scientific standpoint, not where... This is November 1st. We just went through Halloween, and you had a bunch of people dressed up like animals.
Right.
That's not what you're talking about.
Yeah, how do you actually have a scientific and a positive conception, not just, well, man doesn't do this, animals do that, so that's the difference. But what is it about man that makes man different? Okay. What is a positive principle that mankind has and animals don't? How do you understand that? Mr. LaRouche has pointed to, obviously, his own work is probably the most important, I would think, in this respect. And he's also pointed to the work of Vladimir Vernadsky. And Vernadsky's concept of the noosphere is the concept of the domain of action, which is unique to mankind. So that's where this term noosphere comes from. The sphere of influence dominated by the unique activities which are only attributed to the powers of the human mind, of human society, not animals. As contrasted, for example, with his conception of the biosphere, which is the domain of action of animal life.
Yes, which we have right here in the studio.
Right, and we have some...
Trying to assert his view.
Well, I was about to mention the noosphere without mentioning the biosphere, and I think he was protesting to, to that arrogance. Okay. And so from that standpoint, what I see is very provocative and worth putting a lot of thought into is looking at this idea of space exploration from Vernadsky's standpoint. And looking at the idea of what does it really mean? How would Vernadsky look at the idea of the noosphere expanding beyond the Earth and entering the solar system as a principled process? And so that's the solar noosphere concept.
So
in the title.
Vernadsky's idea of the noosphere, he referred to that domain of the Earth, which I think he talks about being so far up into the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. And so far, well, he has the idea of the biosphere, which is the region of the Earth going from the deep into the crust to high up into the stratosphere, where you have a dominance action of life as a principle acting on the non-living parts of the Earth, mm-hmm. and that the noosphere is the region of the Earth in which is being dominated by human thought.
Yeah.
And then you're saying that we have to extend this idea beyond the Earth into the actual solar system. How far can man extend its thought, the influence of human thought into the solar system?
Right. I think one particular phrase Vernadsky used, which I really like, is he titled one of his major books, Scientific Thought as a Geological Force. So like you're saying, the shaping of the geological processes on the planet by human scientific thought, that the causal agent in shaping the surface of the Earth increasingly is the ideas in the human mind.
And he sees this as an absolute natural thing, as a good thing, as an expression of the goodness of the development of the planet, as opposed to the greeny idea that human thought interferes with something natural, that thought is somehow unnatural.
Yeah, absolutely. And in certain writings, he explicitly says that human action in this regard is completely consistent with and improving the anti-entropic tendency of life generally, that life itself has an increasing rate of activity at which it transforms the face of the planet, that it's characterized by a direction of increasing the rate of activity, increasing the anti-entropy, and that mankind's activity is consistent with that principle and takes it even farther. So it's completely natural, this idea of a anti-entropic developing universe, which Vernadsky recognized.
So this gets actually to sort of the fundamental scientific question that you talk about in your paper here, which is that human thought is not, it actually represents something, a fundamental characteristic that's pervasive in the universe, as opposed to you have this universe out there, and then you have this unique thing that human beings do, which is called thinking.
Right.
But the universe is going to do whatever it wants to do, and human thought sort of just interferes with it.
Right. Yeah, I think that's, yeah, I think it's exactly it. And I think that's why Mr. LaRouche often points to the importance of Kepler's work in science, because all of Kepler's work was centered around that, that to understand science, you're talking about investigating principles, principles of the universe. And our best insight into the principles which govern the universe is the ability of the human mind to create and generate creative thoughts itself. That the human mind is, as Kepler showed, consistent with the universe in that respect.
Okay, let's dive in directly to the implications of this, because Vernadsky was roughly contemporaneous with Albert Einstein and mm-hmm. Planck. He came of age in the latter part of the 19th century and did most of his work in the beginning of the 20th century, passing away a little bit earlier than Einstein, about 10 years earlier, 1945, right at the end of World War II. So this was a time of great change in science, revolutionary change in science, but also a revolutionary change in history. Man went from a period that we're pretty much continuing in today, where we went had this great transformation in mankind, say beginning with the Golden Renaissance period, mm-hmm. which broke with the Dark Ages and brought about this idea of human thought and human creativity as the central characteristic feature of human social relations, which brought about the idea of the nation state, the organization of nations based on the common good, the idea that that man must organize his society in order to increase the material conditions of life to be able to increase the creative powers of mankind. And these went hand in hand. When you look at the Renaissance, you see no separation, for example, between science and art. Mm-hmm. That discoveries and artistic discoveries or discoveries about the way man thinks that improve the creative powers of the mind are of the same order as discoveries of scientific discoveries. So, and then that led to the establishment of a new form of government, which came into existence with the Constitutional Republic of the United States, which has that idea enshrined in our founding documents and the concepts of our founding fathers. And that was in contrast to the imperial systems of the British Empire and previous empires, which sort of came to a real conflict is in the second half of the 19th century. With the successful victory of Lincoln over the British in the Civil War, and then that creating the real basis for the first time in history for real continental powers. The continental United States as a continental power, but then also an alliance among sovereign nations in Europe and Asia, especially Russia, China, Germany, and secondarily France, for a Eurasian continental development. So this was all occurring at the time of the and the second half of the 19th century. And this is reflected in science with the final breakdown of all these divisions of science according to sense perception, mm-hmm. as Max Planck said. All these things that people thought were different things.
Right.
Light, heat, energy, mass, all these things that we think are different, between the work of Riemann, Planck, Einstein, you begin to see that there's no real scientific basis for those divisions. They're just illusions of sense perception, matter and energy, something material and immaterial. are really the same thing. And mm-hmm. All these are processes. So we're now freed from all that, and that creates a whole new revolution in science.
Space and time.
Exactly. That's my point. Space mm-hmm. and time. So Einstein establishes a principle of relativity, both with special relativity and general relativity, which I think is very much misunderstood today.
Mm-hmm.
And as it was misunderstood at his time, that somehow these are subjective questions, space and time. But Einstein shows that actually space and time are not purely subjective questions, but it's only a subjective problem with us that we divide things into space and time.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we just start with that? Because what is this issue of space and time as Einstein? Because this is relevant to your paper. In terms of time.
Yeah.
So I think to establish a basis for that, let's first let our listeners in on why is this question of space and time that Einstein dealt with an actual significant scientific breakthrough.
You know, as you're saying, he dealt with this paradox because he came into this conflict with whether light is the speed of light, whether it is an absolute constant speed limit. And he ran into because this is already posed as an idea in physics, that light had a maximum speed at which it could go. And he realized that was a paradox for relative motion. If two people were moving at different speeds, then should they not observe light moving at a different speed, or should it still be the same speed? And to not go through all the details of everything, you know, that posed a paradox as to either this idea of the speed of light, this physical action in the physical universe, whether that was actually the constant, or whether our conceptions of absolute space and absolute time as independent conceptions were to remain as the constant. And he showed that for light to be the constant, this physical action in the universe, then our sense our sense perceptual conceptions of an absolute space and absolute time had to give way and be relative to motion between observers, and the constant in the process was the speed of light. So, you know, you have funny. I cite in the paper, you know, one expression of this idea of what's often referred to as the twin paradox, or Einstein's twin paradox, where you can have two twins that were obviously born at the same time, twins, but if one were to go on a relative space flight and come back and return, then their ages, they'd meet each other at different ages, even though they're born at the same time. Time can actually move differently relative to different observers.
And this is not a subjective question, such as, you know, one person's waiting in the doctor's office and a minute seems like an hour, versus
right.
Somebody who's doing something very interesting and an hour seems like a minute.
Yeah, no, this is
an actual physical difference that they would both experience time,
mm-hmm.
Not just their perception of time, but their ability to know time would be completely different.
And the processes of aging and physics, and these would all vary in correspondence with this. And Vernadsky picked up then on this idea. And this is in line with what Mr. LaRouche has said about where science needs to go, because he's come back to that in a minute. But Vernadsky picked up on this and said, you know, he as far as I've seen, you know, he was very interested in what Einstein did. But then posed the idea that we need to take these conceptions further. And what we need to introduce to better understand the realities of the universe is the conceptions of life and living processes. And to even more fully understand these ideas of what space-time are, energy, matter, these fundamental concepts, as you were saying, all these ideas were being completely overturned around this time period. Energy and mass being expressions of the same thing, space and time being relative and interdependent relative to observers. And Vernadsky came in and explicitly stated, well, this is all excellent and important and, you know, revolutionary work, but we still need to introduce the higher conceptions of life and living processes and study life and living processes and let that further inform our ideas of space, time, energy, and these basic concepts of physics.
Okay, this is important because, as we know, people to this day talk about this question with Einstein as in relativity theory as if it pertains to inorganic matter.
Mm-hmm.
The popular versions, and even Einstein's version, speaks of, you know, measuring rods shrinking and clocks slowing down or speeding up relative to the observer.
Right.
Now, I'm also reminded of a famous debate that took place between Einstein and the French sort of muddle-headed philosopher Henri Bergson.
Uh-huh.
In 1927, it was a very public debate where Bergson said Einstein was wrong about relativity because he doesn't understand time as a purely subjective question, and Einstein was pointing out no. And in fact, Vernadsky was an observer to that debate and took Bergson's side.
Oh, really?
As opposed to Einstein's, or said that Bergson had a more flexible approach. But I think that Bergson was wrong, but Vernadsky's interest in that, looking at time beyond just abiotic processes, beyond
right.
just the interaction among of objects that were not under the influence of life, if
right.
such a thing even exists, but we'll get to that in a minute, occurred. And yet you're saying in your paper that Vernadsky actually looked at this question of took Einstein's principle, which looked at the changing characteristics of space-time with respect to relative motion,
mm-hmm.
whether it's accelerated or non-accelerated motion,
mm-hmm.
And he looked at that in a third variation, not relative motion or accelerated motion, but a third variation, which is the relationship of time with respect to living processes.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
why don't
exactly.
you tell us about that? Because you start with some observational material here, which, as Einstein did, as you mentioned, you know, Einstein had the insight about relativity
mm-hmm.
As a fundamental question about a conflict in the way people generally thought about the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he developed some observational material to force that conflict into the forefront of people's thinking.
Right.
So in your paper, you have some very interesting observational material which actually raises this conflict, which we just discussed,
mm-hmm.
about life versus non-life, that brings that to the fore. So why don't you get it as easily as you can, because
sure.
I know you have a lot of details in your paper,
yeah.
but as easily as you can, give us a picture of what those observations.
Well, and this goes, as you're saying, right off of Vernadsky's ideas. He raised explicitly that living organisms could indeed express a unique self-bounded space-time to the living organism, that space and time characteristics, again, as you're saying, a third factor, not as a function of relative motion, but as a function of the process of life itself to somehow creates its own space-time characteristics within the living organism. So that's what he posed rather explicitly in a number of papers. So we actually came across some of that work after we'd already done a fair amount of work on these questions of evolution and the development of life on Earth. And a lot of what we've been working with on these questions is Mr. LaRouche's concepts of energy flux density and anti-entropy. And I think the easiest way to get at what I opened with is just the process in which I came across some of this work and this paradox for me, which was in these early studies of looking at life, the hypothesis was posed that the energy flux density, the anti-entropy of life on the planet increases over time. So the mammals and the whole class of organisms that goes with mammals, all types of life, types of plant life, tree life, ocean life that go along with this whole mammal system, has a higher energy flux density than the dinosaur system, for example. And there's a lot.
How do we observe that increased energy flux density of mammals versus dinosaurs, for example?
Well, we have certain indications with looking at evidence for metabolic rates, for example.
Okay.
Which is one source of study which I found to be very useful because it is somewhat of a direct measure of this idea of energy flux density. It's literally how much energy does a living organism require to sustain its activity. So you could say, you know, speaking in terms of food, how many calories per day do you need to sustain yourself? You know, how many food calories do you need per day? And then maybe you could take it further per weight, per pound of your body to sustain yourself. You find that in general, organisms like birds and mammals have a much higher level of energetic requirements or energy flux density, energy per time, per mass, than reptiles or other expressions of earlier stages of life. So this is kind of the general thesis we were playing with looking at. You see this also in plant life and in ocean life and all kinds of different stuff. But I came across this funny paradox where if you look at two types of mammals, say a mouse and an elephant, to take two extreme examples, and you take this literal measure of energy per gram, so say joules per second per gram, or calories per day per pound, or whatever you want to measure it in, you get this funny thing where mice seem to have a much higher energy flux density than elephants. And so why would that be the case? They're both mammals. They're both of this mammalian class.
Because the mice are small, they pack a lot of energy into a small space.
Mm-hmm.
And an elephant is big. They distribute that energy over a long period. I guess we should just give our listeners an example, like of energy flux density. The sort of simplified example is that between a sharp and a dull knife. Mm-hmm. Why can a sharp knife, you can cut something very easily with a sharp knife with the same amount of energy, muscle energy, as with a dull knife, because the sharp knife concentrates that muscle energy in a much smaller space.
Right.
And so you have this problem with the mouse, which packs all his energy into a small volume and
right.
mass, but an elephant distributes over a big area.
And then the way it changes has been studied for a while. It's a very interesting, you know, avoid some of the details just for the format here, but the way, how much more energy. And it's not just more energy, it's more energy per mass. So 1 gram of mouse mass, 1 gram of mouse material requires something like 30 plus times more energy per second than a gram of elephant material.
To keep the mouse going.
Just to keep it going, yeah, like a regular rate of energy use just as part of the standard use of, just keep the living organism alive and going. And the value at which this changes for different mammals is somewhat still of an anomaly. There's no real clear reason why it changes the way it does. At first people thought it was a simple geometrical change because larger animals have a larger volume relative to surface area.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought maybe it had to do with heat dissipation because an elephant has much more volume to surface area. So there's less surface area for the heat to radiate out
right.
relative to the volume. But that doesn't actually match up with the rate of change. So anyway, it was kind of an interesting paradox. Didn't really didn't really conflict with the overall picture of the increasing energy flux density of life over evolutionary time, but it was kind of this funny little anomaly. Then coming back to this work a couple years later, more recently.
Before you go into that, let me just let our listeners know it's November 1st, 2014. You're listening to the LaRouche Show, and we're talking here with Benjamin Denniston on his very interesting report, Science for a New Paradigm, Time for a Solar Noosphere. Mm-hmm. So Ben was telling us about the paradox that comes to the fore when you observe living processes from the standpoint of energy flux density.
Right.
Okay, so go ahead.
And then, I don't know how it came across exactly, but then we were looking around and somehow I came across a study that showed that the visual perception of different mammals is actually tied to their metabolic rates.
The visual perception, what do you mean by visual perception?
One fun example is that I haven't done this test myself, but I have heard that for many dogs, if they're watching a television, they won't necessarily see a smooth, continuous motion, but they can actually perceive a series of still images. Because for the dogs, they can perceive, could call it at a higher rate, such that they're not tricked by the frame rate. We watch a TV, if it has a high enough frame rate, frames per second.
Right. We don't see the different frames. We just see it looks like a smooth picture.
Looks like a smooth. It's really a series of still images.
Right.
There's no actual motion.
This is why dogs are better at chasing rabbits than people are.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they do a better job. So
the motion of the rabbit looks like it's in slow motion to the dog.
Right.
Relative to us, it seems very fast.
Yeah, and it's totally different for different animals. I saw one study I was looking at a while ago was looking at tortoises, and they're making the point that they just miss all kinds of things going on all around them. It just doesn't even register. If something happens too quick in front of the tortoise, we would see it happen right in front of us. The tortoise would never know it even happened because it just happened too quick for its perception to register it.
Okay.
So they did a test where the technical term they use for this frame rate for this television example is critical flicker frequency, the frequency at which a series of still images looks like continuous motion.
Okay.
And they found that the smaller the flicker frequency at which you perceive continuous motion is tied to the metabolic rates. So that got me thinking, is like, well, perception apparently seems to be tied to this whole issue of metabolic rates and energy flux density. And then, to make a long story short, that took us to a whole series of papers studying these issues. And it turns out that as soon as you get rid of an idea of clock time in measuring this, and you utilize some type of intrinsic physical time metric, all of a sudden, all these mammals have the same energy flux density values. So instead of measuring energy per gram per second, if you measured energy per gram per heartbeat, now all of a sudden mice and elephants actually have the same value. Or if you measure energy per gram per lifespan on average, you know, these are not, obviously there's a lot that can intervene on an individual lifespan, but if you take the average of a lot of animals over time, then it tends to converge on the same value. Or energy per time to reach sexual maturity per gram or whatever. Any number of these physical values, you start to get this constant. So it raised this idea, and if you look at this from the standpoint of Vernadsky's work, I think he would be very interested in it as expressing a intrinsic time unit for all mammals as a class. That the time experienced by the mouse is actually the same as the time experienced by the elephant. It's actually the same time unit. It's only when they're projected against each other or against the abiotic domain of the biosphere that it appears different.
So this tells us that mammals as a class of living organisms have a certain commonality that's across all mammals, no matter what their size or makeup and so forth. which is different than the same principle with respect to reptiles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Or with respect to what other species of organisms as well?
Yeah. Still looking for more studies on a broader range of things, but different than for amphibians, for example.
Okay.
If you take like...
And how about fish?
Actually, I haven't seen a lot of studies on fish. That would be interesting.
Because you have, you know, mammals that are
yeah.
in the ocean as well as fish too. So.
Yeah, that would be fun to see. There are certain studies of ocean mammals included in some of these that correspond to the same mammalian class. But yeah, it would be fun to see more about different types of fish.
And other types of sea creatures like, you know, invertebrates and
yeah.
those kinds of things.
Yeah, there's a lot more to be done to fill out all. And ideally, it would be good now to take this work that we've done and look at the whole evolutionary record more closely from this standpoint.
Right.
So,
but what this shows us is that there's some difference between, there's some organizing principle in terms of the way living processes organize itself. You raise the evolutionary record, but mm-hmm. even just within a given epoch, like today, you take all the living creatures on the planet, there's a certain hierarchy
mm-hmm.
then that you could say between the different classes, which is based on the whatever we want to call this characteristic, the space-time characteristic
right.
of that class of animals. And what does that difference in space-time characteristic tell us about the relationship of those, that class of creatures with respect to the universe?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we're talking about well, let me get to the main point. I guess we let's get to that point from the standpoint of well, how are human beings different from the animals? What I mean, okay, where do people
yeah.
fit into this thing? We're mammals.
Yeah, right, and that's where it gets fun.
So we have the same space time characteristic as mice or elements.
Yeah, right. So you can count that what I called the mammalian time unit. In this
okay.
paper.
That's a good term.
That defines this minimum perception time, this critical flicker frequency,
okay.
the frame rate, that defines a lifespan, that defines, you know, all these physical time units. But if you actually take a serious look at mankind, we shatter all those. We live far beyond the lifespan of what would be expected for a mammal of our size. Effects of human one thing that was fun to play with, this if you look at time in the very small, again, this critical flicker frequency, the rate of perception, you're talking about milliseconds. Anything shorter than the domain of milliseconds biologically just doesn't exist to the mammalian mammalian organism. It's just too short. It's beyond perception, beyond access to that living organism. Mankind, we now are operating on a domain thousands and thousands and thousands of times shorter than that with our investigations of nuclear physics, chemistry, and our ability to understand and control these processes in the very small. And not just abstractly knowing the rate at which chemical reactions occur and activity in the very small, but actively utilizing our ability to act on that very small domain to then change our relationship to the planet as a whole.
So we
are actually operating in a domain that's orders of magnitude outside of biological or animal perception.
So if you
actively influence our ecological effect overall.
So if you were to apply this calculation that you've applied to our example of mice and elephants and all other mammals, that you can't apply that same method to human beings, right? Because
right.
we break it. There's
yeah.
It's meaningless, right?
Right.
It's a meaningless term.
Mm-hmm. And the intervening factor is, to come back to what we were talking about at the beginning, is creative discovery.
So when we're talking about the difference between mammals and reptiles, for example, we're talking about a difference that's measurable with respect to this characteristic space-time of that class of animals, right?
Yeah.
But when we're talking about the difference between human beings and mammals or and reptiles,
right,
that parameter, that measurement is meaningless. So we now have to have not to, we're not looking at a change in a difference in measurement of the same parameter, like between reptiles and mammals, but we're talking about a new type of parameter, a new measurement.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other interesting expression of this absolute difference, distinction of mankind, is the fact that by new scientific revolutions, we then change those parameters for ourselves. No mammal species changes that parameter. That the equivalent parameter for animals might change over evolutionary time,
mm-hmm.
but that requires evolutionary, biological, morphological change. Change to the nervous system, change to the brain system, change to the physical biology of the living organism over the course of millions and millions of years. Mankind, as you're saying, we've already entered a completely different domain, but we're not characterized by that domain. We continue to change into new domains, go into shorter domains of time, shorter domains of action in these examples. And none of that's biological. None of that's, you know, we don't evolve a second brain,
so if you
larger head or something. It's scientific discoveries that are what defines mankind's existence in the universe.
So if we call this characteristic space, the living space-time parameter,
mm-hmm.
For non-human species,
mm-hmm.
For human beings, there is no such living space-time parameter. There's a new parameter, which we would have to call, say, the noetic space-time parameter.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's our, the definition of time for mankind is not defined, it's defined noetically by the mind, by the powers of discovery, not by any biological expression. And there I think you begin to see at least some initial ways to get it more of a positive conception, a positive idea of what makes mankind different than animals,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just, you know, saying, well, animals do this, but we don't do that, and therefore we're different. Here you're seeing the expression of a power, of a capability that defines what mankind is in terms of his relation to the universe, which doesn't exist in the animal domain. Mm-hmm. And here you're seeing a shadow of that expressed in these issues of time,
mm-hmm.
you know, where time is an expression now of the level of creative thought of mankind.
And this changes from as man's body of scientific and artistic knowledge changes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, somebody today, if you have a proper education, we're not talking about what people get today, but
right.
if you really, you take a newborn baby and you say, okay, I got 25 years to develop this creature intellectually, mm-hmm. to be able to stand at the apex of human creative power. That 25-year period, that one individual would actually assimilate and develop and the capability for the creative discovery and generation of ideas that has taken 50,000 years,
uh-huh.
for example, to develop, right?
Yeah.
Right, so within a 25-year period, 50,000 years of intellectual development can occur.
Right.
And then, you know, 1,000 years from now, that even increases, right?
Right.
But the brain, the biological characteristics of the individuals, as far as we know, at least over that period of time, probably is about the same, right?
Yeah. Yeah, as far as we know, I haven't seen indications any different. Yeah, so it's just a completely different domain you're working in.
Right. So that's an interesting, it causes you to develop a new concept of time, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not, I mean, you know, it's the same, you're not talking about information.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're adding, you know, more hard drives and random access memory chips or whatever to the individual so that more data can be stored, right?
Right.
But a certain creative capacity can be assimilated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can just add one other aspect, which I think adds another element to this whole conception, is if you compare, again, going back to comparing mankind to the animal species, we discussed earlier this idea that over evolutionary time, the energy flux density or the anti-entropy of the biosphere increases. But for that to occur in the animal domain, it literally requires tens of millions of years in evolutionary change to do that. And that's why we talk about geological epochs and eras in terms of tens of millions of years. With mankind, as Vernadsky recognized, mankind is now defining not just one, but potentially a series of new geological epochs, with a corresponding increase in the rate of energy flux density of the biosphere, but not on the scale of millions of years, on the scale of generations.
Mm-hmm.
And not attributed to biological, morphological change, but attributed to this increase of the creative powers of society. So you're seeing, again, if you compare mankind against the biological domain, mankind is in a completely new world. Mankind over generations expresses the scale of action which you'd otherwise only associate with millions of years of evolutionary development. Mankind now encapsulates that and expresses, it's not the same exactly, but mankind encapsulates and expresses that level of increase of activity over the course of a mere generations. And there's an interesting kind of bounded interconnection where the smaller we go in these smaller time domains, going from, say, the domains of chemistry to the domains of nuclear physics, corresponds to these domains of the very large, where the scale of our action is increasingly large. And I think it points to, again, what we opened with, where these issues of time and space are really just shadows, and the determining factor is creative action, creative discovery.
So this idea of noetic space-time is really a characteristic of creative energy flux density,
yeah,
so to speak, which is
absolutely
not, which is not measurable by some unit of energy like a joule,
mm-hmm,
or, you know, the amount of energy or a calorie, the amount of heat required to raise 1 gram of water 1 degree or something like that, right?
Right.
But you're talking about a parameter which is a measurement whose characteristic is itself changing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, you call your paper Science for a New Paradigm. So we've discussed this observational question, but what does this mean with reference to the new paradigm? Lynn and Helga LaRouche have been talking about the new paradigm for mankind.
Yeah.
So tell our listeners about this idea for a new paradigm.
Well, I think it goes to, there's a lot that can be said. My reference is the fact that, especially in the United States and especially in the West, society, culture, science, popular science, it is dominated by this British imperial conception of mankind, as just an animal, as a beast. And what we're seeing with the culmination of the work that Lynn and Helga have been doing in leading the fight for a new system of nations on the world, in cooperation towards joint economic development, we're seeing a lot of that coming into play now, as you open with, major changes in the strategic situation on the planet. And in our discussion with Mr. LaRouche, he's put on the table rather emphatically recently that we have to get more of a focus on this issue of this positive conception of mankind. That we have many nations moving in a completely new direction right now. And as part of that, we need to have a renewed focus on creativity per se? What is it about the human mind, about the creative powers of the human mind itself, that makes mankind what it is? And I think it's important you reference the Renaissance in the beginning, where that was the central issue, and that was then expressed in art and expressed in science and expressed in statecraft. You had a single conception of mankind as a creative force. This is our understanding about how the human mind works, and therefore these are the various expressions of that in these different domains. That's, I think, the level of change, though that is the level of change that we're fighting for in this movement. We're not just fighting for a new specific literal policy change per se. We're fighting for a higher scientific understanding of what mankind is as a creative force in the universe. And the associated policy changes that can help facilitate that, and that are also bounded by that and governed by that conception.
Okay, let's stick with this. We talked about, you bring up the Renaissance, as I did in the beginning, which represented a change in the way man conceived of himself,
right,
in relationship to the universe, but also in relationship to other human beings,
mm-hmm,
right? The Renaissance ushered in the end of the feudalistic idea, where man was identified himself and his relationship to nature and to other, into society, in the way animals do,
mm-hmm,
sort of with a fixed space-time characteristics.
Right.
The Renaissance.
The
feudal system. The Renaissance enters in a new space-time. This era of the creative space-time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is not, as you already demonstrated, this is not a fixed parameter. This is something that can change. The founder of the Renaissance, Nicholas of Cusa, in his final work, discussed something which is been very fascinating to me, which is that, you know, when you're looking at these things like parameters in science or characteristics, they really are not what you're really looking at. They don't govern themselves. They're governed by something that, a higher principle. He called that principle potential or possibility. Mm-hmm. It is, it's the potential to create that. So we look at the lower level human space-time characteristic of life that you describe with mammals and reptiles. This is something that sort of acts as a constraint, right? A mouse can't surpass the elephant in, mm-hmm, its space-time characteristics.
Right.
It has to organize its metabolism and so forth in such a way that is consistent with this space-time of life with respect to mammals,
mm-hmm,
right? But man has the capability to change,
right,
its creative characteristics. And
I think we're really only being truly mankind when we change it.
When we change it. So what is it? So we have a power to make this change, and it's, mm-hmm, that power, the willful power to change things,
mm-hmm,
to change our creative capabilities, which is sort of what makes the change possible,
mm-hmm,
right? So the change itself is not the fundamental thing.
Yeah.
It's the power to make the change.
Right.
And that's a willful power.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about that from the standpoint of what we're talking about here with the new paradigm, is that the new paradigm? The new paradigm where man organizes himself and society with respect to a conscious understanding of the power to change his creative powers.
Yes, I think that's exactly it.
So we're not talking about the creative powers of man per se, we're talking about the power to improve, the power to improve the creative powers.
So yeah.
That's a whole new domain of human relations, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't think that's ever existed. I mean, there's been pockets of that and leaders who have fought for that and people have understood, you know, that to varying degrees, but I don't think that's ever become the global dynamic among leading powers.
But this is what LaRouche is talking about. I guess it was about 3-4 weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, shocked us all in a
Which he likes to do.
Yeah, which he likes to do, which is, of course, the power to change the creative power.
Right.
But he in one of his webcasts, where he said that we're not talking about the nation state, a system of nation states. We're talking about a system of governance, which is based on the principle that brings nation states into existence.
Right. And we're now dealing with a whole planet, not only a whole planet, but a solar system now. And how do we then look at applying this idea of man as a creating new creative states in the context of developing the solar system? And then how do we then define the policies and the agreements between nations to fulfill that goal from that standpoint?
So this, if you think about it from the standpoint of man's relationship or the relationship among the nations on Earth that I began with this question of the collapsing North American and European systems, and this new potential that's represented by Russia, China, India, this more forward-looking approach.
Mm-hmm.
This is the basis for this new dialogue of civilizations, this new set of relationships. And you begin your paper with an important dedication. We have about three, four minutes left. Why don't you tell us about that? What your dedication is, and why you gave that dedication?
Well, I was actually discussing this with my associates, Megan Beats, and she made the point that we're now at the point, given the work that Lynn and Helga have been doing. This is obviously in reference to a very successful conference that Helga hosted over in Europe as part of her series of conferences on a new paradigm, which had very high-level international participation, reflecting the fact that, like you're saying, Russia, China, India are moving in this direction. So now we're at the point where, some of the most powerful forces in the world are orienting in that direction, to the point where this becomes not just nice things to speculate about, but this could actually happen. This could actually be real. We're at a point where enough nations have had enough of this crazy imperial garbage and this perpetual war and perpetual conflict. And they're looking towards new levels of serious discussion and cooperation towards the benefit of each other. And we just saw a very powerful reflection of that desire among leading nations expressed at this conference that Helga held. And so I just think that's, that is the context. We're now, these are ideas that we've been fighting for, I've been fighting for a decade, but other people in this movement have been fighting for many decades. And now we're seeing a point where you're actually getting a convergence of forces where this could actually, things could be moving in this direction. So it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. So that's the idea of the new paradigm, a new paradigm in which we organize society based not merely on the creative powers of man, but on the power to improve the creative powers of man.
Yep.
And we see this, we see that there's already a passion among various nations to bring that about. Like the recent speeches, for example, of the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, about culture and creativity.
Right.
And how the artists must serve this effort to increase the power of the power to change creativity.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in the recent speeches of Narendra Modi, the new Indian prime minister, calling on the young people of his nation to actually lead a scientific revolution. And then the concrete examples of that effectiveness. So this contribution that you've made with your new report is quite exciting. It tells us, it really, I think, is on the level of the kind of new ideas that sort of came to the fore at the beginning of the 20th century and really brings us into a whole new domain. So let me thank you for being with us on
Sure.
the LaRouche Show. This is quite enlightening for our listeners. The title of the report is Science for a New Paradigm, Time for a Solar Noosphere. You can get this at LaRouchePack.com. And you can also see the speeches of the new of this conference, which forms the dedication of this paper, at newparadigm.schillerinstitute.com. So I want to thank you, Ben, for being with us, and thank you all for listening. And I think we've given you something to dig into over the coming period. Thank you very much.